This podcast is brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi, this is Chris Cheney from The Living End, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
From Melbourne, celebrating the 25th anniversary edition of their self-titled album, The Living End, my podcast guest is singer-guitarist from that band, Chris Cheney. G'day, Chris.
G'day. How are you?
Very well. Thank you for doing the podcast with us today. It's a pleasure to have you on. Now, big fan of Living End. I love your energy. It's a cross between, the Sex Pistols and Stray Cats. You know, it's that wonderful, wonderful energy that the three of you bring to the stage. It's marvellous.
Yeah, that was always the thing with us. We figured if we didn't get the people on their feet and we didn't blow the roof off the joint every time we stepped on stage, then we've done something wrong. And if we're not completely exhausted, then we always sort of felt like we'd failed to play a good show. You know, it was really all about the energy. It always has been. And the minute that we're bland and beige or boring on stage, I think it's all over for us.
Is there a pickup in that double bass, or do you just mic the double bass?
Yeah, it's quite a it's a Frankenstein of a double bass. It really is. You know, we started out, when we were 14, 15 years old, carrying that thing around high school. And back then, it just had a very simple kind of little pickup, almost like a violin. But then Scott was like, well, how do you get the clicking sound? You know, it's not just about the notes. It's about that clicking sound that the Bill Haley and, early Elvis records. So then he figured out that there was an extra microphone actually put up under the neck. And so since then, he's now got steel strings. He's had it reinforced so he can stand on it. It's had so much work, but it's been a learning curve over the years.
It's got its own life.
Oh, it really does. And, it's just been an amazing thing because Scott just taught himself basically to play that. He was playing piano when we first met as kids. And I said, let's form a band. And he said, oh, okay. And I showed him a Stray Cats record. And I said, let's do this. Get one of those. And he went, okay. And he went out and bought one like the next day. And then he called me up and said, I got one. Come around and have a look. So I went around to his house. And as I'm getting to the front door, I can hear him inside. He was already playing it. So it was like, was just meant to be.
So let's go right back. Where did you grow up? Where were you born?
Mount Waverley.
Yeah. And what school did you go to?
I went to Highvale Primary and then I went to Gells Park Primary, which was basically Wheelers Hill. So I was born in Mount Waverley and then we moved from Glen Waverley to Wheelers Hill, which is where I did all of my schooling. While I was in Gells Park Primary, that's when my older sister and Scott's older sister became friends. And we were the two little younger brothers riding our skateboards and playing football. And then one day we put those down and picked up guitars and basically formed the band in about 1990. I think we first started playing music together.
How fabulous is that? Oh, my God, it goes right back.
Oh, it really does. Yeah, well, our parents were sort of best friends at first. They were having, like, family barbecues, basically, and that's when I first met Scott. And so we were about 12 or something, I think, when we first sort of started hanging out. And then, as I say, in about 1990, we started playing music together and, our heroes were the Stray Cats. So we called ourselves the Runaway Boys, naturally, and learnt all of their repertoire and all of the 50s stuff. Everyone else at school was listening to Nirvana and Guns N' Roses and we were listening to Buddy Holly and the Crickets.
Excellent. I love that. Of course, when Stray Cats burst on the scene on Countdown, we all sat back and went, oh, my God, look at this band.
Yeah, well, they just became my favourite band. They still are, I suppose, to this day because I love the 50s energy and I loved the 50s kind of guitar playing. I loved Chet Atkins kind of finger picking. I loved, all stuff like the Shadows and all that, like real proper guitar playing, which is what I saw in Brian Setzer. But aside from that, they had the hair and the tattoos and they were like punk rockabilly, I suppose. It had so much energy and so much visual appeal. And for me, a band always has to have a visual appeal as well as sonically being, impressive. So they were the whole package. So when I saw them, I just thought, that's what I want to do. I want to be just like them. And so we kind of a band with them in mind, but also we had a healthy sort of appreciation for the Beatles and for pop music and for great choruses and really well-written songs. We didn't want to just be that 50s kind of hot rod thing. We wanted to incorporate real songwriting into it. So it was definitely a mashup that we had an idea that might work in our head. Then we had to make it a reality.
You mentioned Chet Atkins there. I've done a previous podcast with Tommy Emmanuel, and he told me some great Chet Atkins stories. And Chet opened up the door for Tommy in Nashville. And look at Tommy now. He's touring all around the world.
I know. I mean, he's I think Chet was probably the greatest of all time, and I think Tommy's probably now the greatest of all time. You know, I mean,
Tommy was voted in the number five guitarists in the world.
Yeah. I've so much admiration for him, and to me that's true guitar playing, when you use all 10 fingers, not just playing chords and just strumming. You know, he's as close to a master, I think, as anyone, and he's the CGP, isn't he? Certified guitar player from Chet.
Exactly right. And he uses every part of that goddamn maiden, doesn't he? You know, the neck, everything.
I'm a guitar player, but I feel like I'm not even in that realm. You know, he's a real kind of guitar player. It's a different sort of thing. I think I could practice every day until the end of time and I'd never be that good. He's just a natural.
So were you self-taught guitar all those years ago?
No, I started learning at Gells Park Primary School.
Just taking lessons, chords and all of that, huh?
Yeah, one of the music teachers at school started doing these group lessons at lunchtime, and I hated it because I could hear all the other kids outside kicking the footy, and I didn't want to be inside playing the guitar because you can't play at that point. It's just, you're just struggling. It hurts your fingers. You don't know what you're doing. For some reason, I stuck with it. And then I got another guitar player as I entered high school, a guy called John Cupid. And now John was an older guy who had basically was English, and he had grown up playing all of that Chet Atkins stuff, and he was a Hank Marvin freak. And so that was just as I was kind of getting into those records and that style of music. So I could see him actually playing it right in front of my eyes in the same room. And so that was the turning point. So then I just never put the guitar down. And then I went to music college after school to study jazz. Yes, so thank you, Mum.
Good on Mum. Yes, she had the vision. I love it. Tobin Brothers believe every life is unique. Every funeral should be too. Visit turbanbrothers.com.au.
Hi, this is Chris Cheney from The Living End, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
I'm speaking with Chris Cheney from The Living End, and it's a pleasure to have him with us on the podcast today. Chris, now tell me, where did you get the name The Living End? And were there bands before The Living End, or did it just grow into The Living End?
It grew into The Living End, yeah. It was our bass player, Scott, and myself, and we had a couple of different drummers in high school. Drummers were very hard to hang on to.
To keep up.
To self-destruct drummers. So we've had a few different ones over the years. Andy, of course, has now been with us for 20 years. I mean, he's the drummer in the band. But, yeah, so when we first started playing, we were a cover band because, as everyone is, you don't know how to write your own songs at that point. We called ourselves Runaway Boys as a Stray Cats kind of tribute thing. And in about 95, you know, we always had this idea of being able to be an original band, but we just didn't really know how to do it. So we went from sort of playing people's 21sts, and we played weddings. We were like a function band for a few years to trying to get gigs in pubs in the city as this original band. And we thought, well, if we're going to be an original band, we probably need an original name. So I was watching the movie Rock Around the Clock.
Yeah, Bill Haley.
Yeah. And at the end of that, as the credits roll, it says The End, and then it parts and it says The Living End. And I went, that's a good name for a band. So that's when we changed it at that point.
That's fantastic.
I thought it was just a great name for a band. I've always been into, you know, bands like The Clash and, as you mentioned, The Sex Pistols. It was really important for me to have a name that sounded super cool but also sounded kind of neutral. The Living End could have been any kind of band. It just sounded like a rock band, and that's what we wanted to be, was not pigeonholed. So yeah, it was 95, I think, that we became The Living End, and we started writing pretty much all our own material and playing to no people.
That kind of galvanised the band, because your debut album, The Living End, was a smash. Think about that, all those years of writing songs, yeah. And, you know, and nurturing those songs, and all of a sudden you put them on an album, and, you know, it was number one on the ARIA charts. It was on the charts for 63 weeks.
Yeah.
Astounding stuff for a first album, man.
It was. It changed our lives. We got successful more than we ever could have imagined. You know, I always thought that what we were doing was appealing, that if we liked it, other people would like it. But you don't expect that kind of success. But, you know, it kind of makes sense to me now in a way, because we're all those years down the track and those songs have become part of people's lives and they've stood up today. But at the time, they were just the songs that I wrote during those couple of months. But it's funny, when something is really on the outside like that, like we were the alternative to the alternative. You know, we're into like the Seattle grunge scene. That was kind of the alternative. Well, we were playing like 50s rockabilly, psychabilly kind of mashup thing that I thought, it's never going to get played on commercial radio. You know, we might have a little bit of success. So when it actually did become mainstream, I guess it was so different that people just went crazy for it.
Triple J were all over it.
Yeah, that's right. And I think when, you know, back then we had like, you know, young kids were getting into the band and they saw us and thought, well, they don't look like any of the other bands that I've ever seen before and they don't sound like that. So when it hit big, it hit really big because it stood out like a sore thumb. But I had many years where we were hitting our head against the wall thinking we're never going to get anywhere in this music industry, because there were a lot of bands that were, and we just thought, what have we got to do to get a foot in the door?
Well, the good thing is you did your apprenticeship and you appreciated the whole wave when it crashed all over you and you had to, all of a sudden you're a headline act and, you know, you'd been working up to that stage and that's why you're still here, still successful, because you had that grounding behind you.
Well, that's right, yeah. We definitely paid our dues. All those gigs that we did in Mildura, so 30 people, hundreds of gigs before we ever got notice or a record deal. So I think by the time that that record became a success, people would come to our shows and they'd be like, holy hell, like, you know, they can really play, because we had done so many miles and we wanted to be a band that could really play well. We didn't want to just play the songs. We looked up to, you know, our heroes were proper musicians. So it was important to us to be able to play the heck out of our instruments.
Well, if you look at the same story with the Beatles when they played in Hamburg seven nights a week.
Yeah.
That's where they got tight.
That's right. I feel bad. A little bit bad for bands coming up these days, because there isn't the platform to do it. There isn't the amount of venues. There isn't the kind of, there isn't the support network. And people have got so many other options these days as far as going out. They don't necessarily go to a local pub and see bands perhaps like they did back then. I feel like we were sort of at the tail end of that Aussie pub rock scene, you know, and doesn't really exist the same now, but it was great for us because we could do a lot of shows. There was a lot of people going to shows. I don't know what bands do now to start out. I mean, I guess they go on, if they want to, they go on a television reality show. We just rolled up our sleeves. It was good old blue collar, you know, hard work, just learning how to play, trial by fire, really.
Before I get into the success of Living End and all your albums and singles, and which there are many, I want to talk about this iconic album. Now, tell me about the artwork. The artwork on the cover is extreme and makes a statement. How is that process for you?
Well, we always did all of our own artwork. We were very much from that DIY kind of school, and Scott and I had both done art and drama at high school. We actually didn't have music at Wheelers Hill High School, funnily enough. For some reason, there wasn't really a music program, so we sort of diverted to doing art and drama. So when it came to doing the artwork for the band and T-shirts and even the logo, I pretty much drew all that sort of stuff because I always had the vision in my head. But that photograph was actually supplied by one of the guys at our record company, a guy called John O'Donnell, who worked for Murmur. He's very instrumental in Silverchair's career. And he provided that photo. He goes, I found this cool photo online. It was very early days of online. And it was titled Women Workers in a Bomb Factory. And we just thought it was a really striking kind of photo.
Oh, it is.
Red and black had always been kind of sort of the colours that we had liked. So we just put this sort of filter over, and I had the Living End was that sort of logo was what I sort of designed. And I don't know, we didn't think about it too much. It became a very kind of recognisable sort of cover, I guess. We just drew it and just used our own handwritten lyrics and all that sort of stuff because we didn't have anyone else to do it, and we liked it. You know, we liked it, the design side of it.
Well, good on you. Well, 8 studio albums, which means that you're not a one-hit wonder. You've got substance and a big, big future. 8 studio albums, 23 singles, 6 EPs, and also there's a couple of 4 video albums and 3 compilation albums. I mean, that's a great body of work.
It is a great body of work. It's funny, people have said, God, does it feel like 25 years since the first record? And on one hand, it doesn't. But if I listen to what you've just said and I do look at what we've achieved and we've seen the world, you know, we've released a lot of records and had, you know, a few moments of great success, not just the first record. In 2005, we had a record called State of Emergency, and that was, we played the biggest shows of our career at that point. And then in 2009, we released White Noise, and it got bigger again. So I'm very thankful that we've had these kind of spikes in our career, because not everybody gets them, so...
Prisoner of Society and Second Solution, the double A single, that was the number one single of the whole 90s. I mean, that's amazing, man.
Yeah, so that came out before we went into the studio to make our record. That was the single, we called it a double A side. And it was when we put that out and we were touring around the country with, I think it might have been a Jebediah, perhaps, and we were supporting them, I think, at that point. And by the end of the tour, I think, you know, it was that old thing, everyone was there to sort of see us. It was incredibly exciting. It went crazy, that single. And the thing about Prisoner, everyone thinks that that's kind of our calling card song, but that was actually the second song on the EP. We didn't think anything of it, so we put it second. If we thought that it was a monster hit that it was, we would have absolutely had that as track one. But it's kind of cool that we weren't thinking that way back then. It was just, here's a couple of songs that we've written, here's the artwork, let's put it out and see what happens. And it just went nuts.
So how did you feel when the record company, John O'Donnell, said, you've just charted in America?
It had been a steady kind of climb. You know, I just remember, if I think about like back in 96 even, when we sent a tape and a T-shirt and some things over to the guys in Green Day because they were coming to Australia. And we basically sent them a letter and said, can we support you, you know? And we got that tour and we were pretty much unknown at that point. And they gave us a real leg up and that basically put us on the map here. So that was a huge moment. And then when that record came out was another huge moment. And then the next logical step was to kind of go overseas, I suppose. So it was just, when you're 22 and all this stuff is happening, it was like I said earlier, it was like every dream that Scott and I had was sort of, it was beyond what we had imagined the success could ever sort of be. And, you know, now it's a different world, of course. But if I think about it back then, yeah, just doing the Letterman show and, you know, arriving in LA and having our heroes and stuff come to the shows, people from Blondie and stuff were coming to see us play. You know, it was like, this is crazy, you know. So I feel very blessed.
Any song can be played at a funeral. What would you like? Visit TobinBrothers.com.au.
Hi, this is Chris Cheney from The Living End, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
So 25 years later, you're now just dropping this week the 25th anniversary album of your first album. Now, tell me about, is it the same songs, different songs? What's on the 25th anniversary album?
So it's the record repackaged, basically. It's the original record, but it comes with a second disc, which is a Live at the Wireless from Triple J in 1998. There's no point sort of trying to redo the record or do anything different with it because that's what we're celebrating is what that record was, which was a moment in time. So it comes with an extra disc. It comes with a 35-page booklet, which is pretty cool. I've always been into those box set kind of things that bands put out where you flick through and you see all those rare photos and, you know, ticket stubs and memorabilia and stuff. So I've raided my archive and found all this really cool stuff, and this guy did this incredible 35-page booklet with all this extra added stuff in there, and it's a real trip down memory lane. And the thing about it is we've never really done an anniversary before. We've never been one of those bands to have spent too long looking back. I feel it's important to move forward, but this is such a special record that we couldn't ignore it, so we thought, right, well, we can either do nothing or we can go big. So we booked that show at Festival Hall and that sold out in a week, which was incredible.
I know. How How cool was that? Selling out in a week, you know, all those months ago. No one could get in.
We thought it might have been a bridge too far, to be honest. But again, we just thought, well, we don't really want to just do something little. We want to make a statement and celebrate it in a big way. Maybe we can pull it off, you know. But yeah, sold out in a week. So we're stoked about that. And so I guess with the record, it's a chance to sort of just acknowledge what that record was. And it was a big record, not just for us, but for a lot of people of our generation. You know, I think being on the inside, we'd sort of forgotten the impact that it had. And our manager was like, we can totally do something special for this because that's a very special record. We went, oh, yeah, I guess.
Well, it'll go number one again. You know that.
How do you think so? How do you think so?
Oh, it's an iconic album that is in everybody's mind. It people will jump on this, particularly the 35-page booklet, the extra album, the live album, plus this. It's a Monty to go to number one and stay there for quite some time.
Well, I hope you're right, Gavin Wood. I hope you're right. But, you know, the cool thing about it is the vinyl rediscovery. So that's where this record, you know, will... It's in a great format in the vinyl thing because, you know, it's a big kind of booklet and, you know, it's a really nice-looking kind of package. So, yeah, see what happens, eh?
Well, mate, good luck with it. It's an absolute pleasure talking to you. I had a great chat. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you after all these years.
And, mate, I love the band. I love your energy. And man, The Living End is right up there. I love someone that puts on a great show.
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, that was all we had in the early days. We didn't have any songs. We didn't have any record company support. We only had the three of us. And it was about blowing the roof off, you know, because those were the bands that, whether it was The Oils or whoever it was, or Chisel, you know, it on stage, go home, you know. So I'm so glad that we had that as our foundation and we've just built on that.
Well, long may you reign, my friend.
Thank you.
All the very best.
All right, thanks.
This podcast brought to you thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives every day of the year.